the studios of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Uprising, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. It's Friday, June 19th, 2015. On today's show, we'll go live to Charleston, South Carolina, to examine the aftermath of the church massacre, what its roots are, and whether there can be justice. And we'll have a live report from a rally commemorating the 25th anniversary of the Justice for Janitors campaign. Plus, a groundbreaking new study finds a strong link between pregnant women who were exposed to DDT and their daughters who developed breast cancer. That's coming up after the news. Joining us now to analyze today's headlines is Arun Gupta, journalist and a regular contributor to The Guardian in these times, The Progressive and Truthout. Hi, Arun.
Hi, Sonali.
Undeterred by a Senate defeat on the Trans-Pacific Partnership fast-track bill, the Republican Party and White House strategized to send the trade bill authorization back to the House to start over. The House voted on a fast-track bill without added assistance for U.S. workers in a vote of 218 to 208. Right-wing Representative Paul Ryan explained the vote in this way, quote, "This is a vote for American leadership. This is a vote to declare that America still has it. This is a vote to reestablish America's credibility. The world is watching." There has been widespread opposition among those in the U.S. public who actually know what the TPP is, as well as a good portion of the Democratic Party. Well, Arun, what do you make of Paul Ryan's statement? And also, could this version of the bill pass the Senate?
Well, in terms of his statement, you know, few people actually know what it is. These deals are kept secret, so that's not really that honest in the first place. And in terms of could this deal pass, yes, and that's the problem. You know, they in terms of the corporations and their allies in the political process will keep coming back again and again and again and again to try to pass this bill because it means so much to them, so much in terms of profit accumulation. So it's not a done deal that this is stalled.
And then the international human rights organization Amnesty International has just released a new report on policing in the United States. It's called Deadly Force: Police Use of Lethal Force in the U.S. The group examined law enforcement in all 50 states and concluded that, quote, "The United States has failed to respect and protect the right of life, the right to life, by failing to ensure that domestic legislation meets international human rights law and standards on the use of lethal force by law enforcement officers." Additionally, the report stated that, quote, "The limited information available suggests that African-American men are disproportionately impacted by police use of lethal force," and added many African-American women have also lost their lives to police violence. Arun, how useful is such a report, particularly as it measures the U.S. to international standards?
These reports are important insofar as the constant drumbeat in terms of revelations that have come out since Ferguson last year. You know, to really say that the U.S. police are out of control systematically, it's not a question of a few rotten apples. The whole barrel is rotten. Whether or not, though, it forces any change, that really depends on building a powerful movement because the police are so resistant to change and the police exist essentially to protect the wealthy. But the fact that, you know, Amnesty International says every single one of the 50 states fails by this international standard, I think that's both eye-opening and appalling at the same time.
And finally, the United Nations has issued a dire warning about North Korea's years-long drought. Food production in the country has fallen by half, as media described the drought as, quote, the worst in 100 years. An earlier report found that there are now 10.5 million hungry people in North Korea. That's more than twice the number in 1990. North Korea has been highly isolated internationally by Western countries and their allies, and a dictatorial regime has reportedly not kept up agricultural infrastructure, which has in turn exacerbated the problem. Of course, climate change has also likely worsened the severity of the drought, but few reports have raised that issue. So, Arun, who is responsible for North Korea's situation? I mean, at least other poor nations that have trouble adapting to climate change have some sort of global relations that can provide aid. Are North Koreans simply going to starve?
Well, unfortunately, it may look that way, which is what happened in the early 90s. Certainly, the West, especially the U.S., bear a lot of responsibility. The U.S. and North Korea has still not signed a formal peace treaty from when the Korean War ended more than 60 years ago. No doubt that the North Korean regime is extremely cruel and dictatorial, but the U.S. prevents all sorts of basic aid from getting there, and a lot of it has to do with kind of long-term economic mismanagement by the North Korean leaders. A few people remember that up until the 1970s, North Korea was actually considered a development model for the third world, but that's when its infrastructure started to deteriorate across the board.
And of course, yesterday, the encyclical presented by Pope Francis on the issue of climate change has also added to the discussion around climate change as a whole. Well, Arun, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you.
Arun Gupta sitting in for Christina Mislan. He's a journalist and a regular contributor to The Guardian, In These Times, The Progressive, and Truth Out. On today's show, after this break, we'll go live to Charleston, South Carolina, where our other Daily Newsflash guest expert, Chenjerai Kumanyika, is. And he drove there yesterday evening. He's normally based in South Carolina at Clemson University, but he'll be joining us live from Charleston. We'll also speak with Ajamu Baraka to discuss the latest on the church massacre in Charleston. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. 21-year-old Dylan Storm Roof was arrested yesterday in the massacre of 9 people at the Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina. The young white man had slipped into the church and sat in the pews for an hour before he opened fire. One of the survivors reported that Roof explained his motivation while shooting by saying, quote, "You rape our women and you're taking over the country, you have to go." He apparently reloaded his gun 5 times during the course of the shooting. A 5-year-old girl apparently survived the massacre by playing dead. The FBI has opened a hate crimes investigation into the shooting, but as of now, there are no reports that it is being investigated as a terrorist act. Here are the names of those who were killed. Church pastor and state senator Clementa Pinckney, 54-year-old librarian Cynthia Hurd, church pastor, speech therapist, and girls track and field coach Sharonda Coleman Singleton, 26-year-old Taiwanza Sanders, church janitor, 70-year-old Ethel Lance, church member and Lance's cousin, 87-year-old Susie Jackson, 49-year-old DePayne Middleton Doctor, who was the retired Charleston County Director of the Community Development Block Grant Program, 59-year-old church pastor Mira Thompson, and 74-year-old Daniel Simmons Sr., who died on the hospital operating table. Joining me now live from Charleston is Chenjerai Kumanyika. He's an assistant professor of communication studies at Clemson University in South Carolina. He drove to Charleston last night, and he's, of course, Uprising's Daily Newsflash guest expert on Thursdays. Also with Chenjerai is A.D. Carson, a student based in Charleston. I'd like to welcome both of you to the program.
Hi, Sonali. Hello.
So, Chenjerai, you are in Charleston, so can you give us a sense of the significance of what happened yesterday and how it's being felt inside Charleston? What is the atmosphere there right now?
Well, you know, we got here last night and we just spent about, 4 or 5 hours in front of the church talking to people. And I think there's still a stage, I mean, people feel it, but I think there's still a stage of almost, it's unbelievable and inconceivable. I mean, and I don't want to say the wrong thing here in the sense that people are surprised, because I don't think that that's the sense I got from anybody. but just this, the act is so enormous that it's taking people a while to process it.
A.D. Carson, what are your thoughts on this as well? And tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, my thoughts are, I think, echoed in Chenjerai's about how people felt out there. Just the, I mean, I guess the nature of the act is such that I think folks really do, and myself included, have, you know, sort of paused to reflect upon it, and it still, it doesn't seem real.
I want to play an excerpt of the Reverend Clemente Pinckney speaking at his church, the church where the massacre took place on Wednesday, the Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston. It's a historic church. This was the Reverend Pinckney speaking in 2013, describing a little bit of the church's history.
My name is Reverend Clemente Pinckney. And as of a couple of weeks ago, I'm in my fourth year of pastoring here at the church. And along with pastoring here at Mother Emmanuel, since the year 2000, it's been my privilege to serve the people in South Carolina Senate District 45 in the state legislature. Where you are is a very special place in Charleston. And it's a very special place because this church and this site, this area, has been tied to the history and life of African Americans since about the early 1800s. This church was built in 1891. The congregation was formed in 1818 by the Reverend Morris Brown, who later became the second bishop of the African Methodist Episcopal Church. And for those of you who may know a little something about our denomination, we started in 1787 through our founder, Richard Allen, who left then St. George's Methodist Episcopal Church because they were telling him he needed to pray after the regular members prayed. And so that's how a denomination began, in a fit of civil disobedience and a little issue with theological fairness, if you will.
And that was the Reverend Clemente Pinckney, former state senator, I should just say state senator, who was one of the nine people massacred at the Emmanuel AME Church 2 days ago. And in the excerpt that you just heard and watched, he was speaking in 2013 inside of that church for our TV audience. Just a beautiful church, magnificent church with a lot of history, very, very, you know, hundreds of years old history. Now, Chenjerai, how important is this church to the local community there? People refer to it as Mother Emmanuel.
Absolutely. And, you know, the young people we spoke to had a real sense of history, a history of the church, and also of Senator Pinckney as a leader. And, you know, that was interesting because you don't always find young people being deeply connected to politics. But this church, I mean, you just can't underscore such a rich history, right? It's completely, you know, a key moment and a key structure for the entire, you know, denomination of African Methodist Episcopal. It was the church where, you know, Denmark Vesey was planning his uprising. And it's just really a focal point in Charleston, which is a city which already has a deep history when it comes to being an entrance point for, you know, African slaves into the U.S. and just South Carolina's resistance. So it's all these things are laid. It's just really important. And the thing is that talking to people last night, the citizens here have a real strong sense of that history, and they understand that this act was symbolic.
A.D. Carson, are you from Charleston?
No, I'm actually from Illinois. I'm a student at Clemson.
I see. So you came down with Chenjerai. How has this incident, how do you see this incident, you know, just given everything else that's been happening, not just with vigilante violence against African Americans, but police violence as well?
Well, because a large part of my work deals with trying to examine how history affects us today, I think that it fits into this larger narrative of things that are going on that seem to be repeats of things that we've seen in the past. If we examine history, then we get a pattern that's not unfamiliar at all.
And I should mention that a white man at a church in Richmond, Virginia, yesterday reportedly knocked on the doors of a black church and threatened to kill everybody inside. Nothing happened of that in the end, but he did have a tirade. He has been taken into custody. The atmosphere around the country, but particularly in and around black churches and the black community, is likely pretty grim these days. How is and I understand there were also a few bomb threats at other churches in Charleston yesterday that were luckily, that nothing came of. So Chenjerai, how is the community responding? How are people coming together? We're seeing photographs of flowers and candles, etc., near the site of the church. What is the sense, and particularly in the white community in Charleston, are people coming together?
Well, you know, I can't really speak fully to that. I mean, I was in front of the church last night, and there was, you know, it was a diversity of different kinds of people were there in front of the church, just kind of paying their condolences and respect. I mean, I get the sense that we're still in the very beginning stages of something that's going to evolve into and really continue a new level of the Black Lives Matter movement in relation to this, but it's going to be maybe a little bit different in South Carolina. You know, things here are very much organized around the church, and so, you know, you see people holding church services, and a lot of what's happening has happened in churches down here. There is a protest scheduled tomorrow in Columbia, because now the Confederate flag is something that's coming up as a re-emerging in South Carolina as an important site for struggle.
And let's talk about that. The shooter himself was interested in the symbols of the Confederate flag on his clothing. He sported apartheid-era patches from white South Africa and Rhodesia. These are, of course, known symbols of white supremacist groups. And there are several of these groups in South Carolina, as there are in other parts of the country. But Governor Nikki Haley said, you know, she decided to fly the Confederate flag outside the state house. And it's interesting that both the state government and this racist shooter embraced this symbol. How important is it symbolically for people that the governor stopped flying this flag?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. AD, I was wondering if you could comment, because there was something that came up last night in the conversation about the sincerity of her language.
Well, you know, another one of these situations that come up looking at history, we see that the office Nikki Haley holds is the same office held by Benjamin Tillman, who in 1876 was a part of a very similar act. Simon Coker was a state senator who asked if, after the Hamburg massacre, if he could pray for a moment. And as he's praying, it's described as the two men killed him as he prayed. And so I think the sincerity of Nikki Haley's words must be taken into question, as she holds the same office that got Benjamin Tillman elected to governor after an act that sort of bookmarks this, if we look at it historically.
Nikki Haley said, "We do know that we'll never understand what motivates people to commit acts of violence such as this." And that's really interesting. A white man walks into a church, makes racist statements, massacres 9 people. What's not to know? It's pretty clear what motivated him, right?
It's crystal clear. And, you know, this really gets to the heart of the matter here. You know, one of the things that it's tempting to look at South Carolina as some kind of aberration when it comes to racism, but what I think we're growing into consciousness of now is that the problems of colorblind racism in South Carolina are, you know, something that are certainly deep-rooted here, but it's something that we're dealing with throughout the country. Things being characterized as not being about race, things being characterized as being, you know, people who are trying to raise these issues being characterized as race baiters. And something else I want to bring up is that, and this came up in our conversation last night, as Nikki Haley said the words and gave her very emotional expression, a lot of people down here doubted the sincerity of that, because she was saying those words into literally looking at the Confederate flag.
Wow.
So how can you expect to be taken seriously when you have these symbols? And, you know, all around us last night here, right 2 blocks down from the corner of the church is a large statue of John C. Calhoun, the senator and 7th vice president who argued that slavery is a positive good. So you have these symbols all around us here in Charleston, and yet on the same time, people proclaiming that things aren't about race. It's incredible.
Nikki Haley, who makes me ashamed to be South Asian, gave this explanation when confronted about the Confederate flag. She said, quote, over the last 3.5 years, I've spent a lot of my days on the phones with CEOs and recruiting jobs to the state. I can honestly say I have not had one conversation with a single CEO about the Confederate flag. I certainly couldn't make any sense of that statement, and I'm guessing you can't either. I also want to talk about Senator Lindsey Graham, the senator from South Carolina who spoke about the shooting. His niece went to school with the shooter, Dylan Roof, and he said in an interview on CNN, quote, I think he's just one of these whacked out kids. I don't think it's anything broader than that. It's about a young man who is obviously twisted. Again, this attempt to completely isolate this incident as something that's an aberration for which there's just no explanation and therefore nothing can be done about it. Right, Chandra?
Absolutely. And what we're seeing now is people are starting to come into a more sophisticated understanding of the idea and concept of white supremacy. Yes, it's something that interacts with class. Yes, it's something that interacts with all these other oppressions, but white supremacy is not something that's under a hood. When you see someone like this kid going to school with Lindsey Graham's children, what you realize is that these problematic views are all around us. They're not under hoods, they're with our families and they're in the mouths. The things that I want to point out that Dylan Roof said were things that have been said, you know, are discourses that I see on Fox News, that I see in the mouths of politicians, that have been said historically about fears about who's taking over the country and fears about who's raping who and all these kinds of things. So, you know, we have to begin to talk about these things and recognize how they're spread out. Also, and I do want to be clear, when we talk about white supremacists, we're against white supremacy, not white people. And as you're pointing out with Nikki Haley and with, you know, many kinds of people of all, you know, identity categories can promote these problematic views.
Yeah, a few years ago, she said in an interview she considers herself white. So certainly the ideology of white supremacy isn't necessarily restricted to whites. Finally, I wanted just to ask you about the pain that people go through when such things happen. Social media has become a very important medium of expression. One person posted the following tweet. They are praying, P-R-E-Y-I-N-G, while we are praying, as in worshiping. And another said, quote, one of the scariest parts is that though white folks rarely came to our church, whenever they did, they were treated so well, so well. So I know that I am alive and working because of the sound, smell, and faith of the black folks in my black Southern church. Now they are killing us there. Chandrai and A.D. Carson, finally, how important is it for us to understand the pain of a community that is again being targeted?
Well, I think it's extremely important for us to take just a moment to think about and honor those folks who were there. And I heard someone say it's likely that as Dylan Roof was beginning to take the lives of the people, they were probably praying for him. And I think that that's a testament to the power of the faith of the folks in that church and many churches countrywide. And we should just really kind of think for a moment and really, I don't know, I guess it's really even hard for me to put into words right now, because it feels so unreal even making that statement that they were probably praying for him as he was preparing to take their lives. It's difficult.
They welcomed him into the church, yeah.
They welcomed him. And let me just say this just real quick, Sonali. You know, both AD and I are African-American men. Both of us saw this tragedy, and we're in the state of South Carolina. And so, you know, it's weird. We both do, you know, I'm a journalist and we both writers and scholars, but we're also here just as people who are trying to process this, as black men trying to process this. And, you know, it's just it's challenging because there's anger that you're trying to negotiate. There's structural issues that have to be dealt with here. And you see them in Charleston. And there's just, like you said, the really harsh reality of this tragedy.
I want to thank the two of you so much for joining us and spending this time with us. Best of luck to you.
Thank you.
A.D. Carson is a student at Clemson University in South Carolina, where Chenjerai Kumanyika is also based and where he is an assistant professor of communications studies. This is Uprising, and we're talking about the massacre in Charleston, South Carolina, that took place on Wednesday. And the shooter, Dylan Roof, was just apprehended. President Obama delivered a statement about the Charleston massacre yesterday. Among the things that he said was this: "We don't have all the facts, but we do know that once again, innocent people were killed in part because someone who wanted to inflict harm had no trouble getting their hands on a gun. Now is the time for mourning and for healing, but let's be clear. At some point, we as a country will have to reckon with the fact that this type of mass violence does not happen in other advanced countries. It doesn't happen in other places with this kind of frequency, and it is in our power to do something about it." Several folks have commented on the fact that if anybody has the power to do something about it, it is the president himself. My guest is Ajamu Baraka, who is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. He's also an editor and columnist for Black Agenda Report. Welcome to Uprising, Ajamu.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Are you glad that Obama made such a strong statement on gun violence, but perhaps disappointed? He said very little about race and racism, and certainly almost nothing. I don't think he even mentioned the word, and very few people have mentioned the T word, terrorism.
Well, you know, yes, I'm disappointed, but then I'm not surprised.
Ajamu? We just lost your audio. We might have to call you right back. Ajamu Baraka from the Institute for Policy Studies. Can you hear me, Ajamu? Uh-oh. Okay, we're going to try to call you right back. Ajamu Baraka again, my guest to discuss the situation in South Carolina and in the aftermath of the massacre there. And he is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, an editor and columnist for the Black Agenda Report. By the way, there is today is June 19th, and it is also essentially Juneteenth. And I'm going to be asking Ajamu about the significance of that as well. Ajamu, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so you were saying about Obama?
That I was disappointed but not surprised that he would focus then on the issue of the availability of guns as opposed to the militarization of this culture, the violence that seems to be at the center of the American experience. It's not about just guns. It's about the fact that you have an aggressive, violent, growing militant racist right wing in this country. This individual was not deranged. He was a white nationalist militant. It wasn't about the availability of guns. It's about his racist ideology. So yes, it was a diversionary kind of comment that did not help people to understand the realities that black people and people of color in the U.S. are facing.
Well, it seems as though the availability of guns is just one ingredient in a big picture. And when you mix the two, the vast availability of guns with this sort of toxic racist culture in our country, you get an extremely dangerous result, right?
Exactly. But if it was concerns about guns and violence, then he would not have told the Black Lives Matter activists at the White House that he was unprepared to suspend the 1033 program that transferred massive military arms from the federal government to police forces on the local and state level. So it's not serious.
Now, of course, if Dylann Roof had been a Muslim or brown or both, this would not have been called a hate crime. It would have been called a terrorist attack. What's the difference between the two other than religion and race of the perpetrator?
There's no difference.
Ajamu, we're going to have to bring you on the phone while we keep your video on. We're sorry, there does seem to be a bit of a technical issue with our audio this morning, but certainly we will attempt to bring you right back as we discuss the situation with Dylann Roof and also the hypocrisy in the media coverage of this massacre that many are urging needs to be deemed a terrorist attack. There isn't very much difference between the between this incident and others. Ajamu, we're trying to call you on your phone. So if you can pick up your phone while we're trying to reach you, that would be great. And then we'll bring you on, bring your audio that way. Again, my guest is Ajamu Baraka. He is with the Institute for Policy Studies, an editor and columnist for Black Agenda Report. We are also going to be discussing a little bit later in our conversation how the fact that how right-wing conservatives are turning this into an issue of religion, an attack on religion, because it happened in a church. So, Ajamu, continue your conversation.
Yes, I'm so sorry. I'm getting a signal out here. I'm in the country.
Okay.
In Virginia countryside.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yes, I was saying that basically this is not a serious conversation being led by the President of the United States, that the issue is not the availability of guns, but the challenge, the threat of this growing right-wing movement in the U.S., this racist right-wing movement. And he needs to be able to be honest so that people can understand what it is that we're up against here in this country. So, no, it was not a serious a comment. He did not mention the fact that this was, in fact, a terrorist attack. And to understand it, you have to put it within the context of all of the other kinds of terrorist activities we are facing in this country, both from individuals and from the state.
Now, what about the fact that some are calling this an attack on religion because it happened in a church? Senator Lindsey Graham said the shooter might have been looking for Christians to kill.
No, because these individuals have a sense of history, they understood the importance of that church. That was the same church in which Denmark Vesey helped to organize one of the what would have been a major slave uprising in the United States. It was he shot that church up on the same day, the anniversary of the day in which the uprising was scheduled to occur. So this wasn't about Christianity. This was about race and about protecting white privilege and about protecting the colonial project that we know of as the United States of America.
Now, Ajamu, today is Juneteenth, and there's a lot of history there as well. Can you explain for our audience the significance of that history?
Well, you know, once the proclamation was issued by Abraham Lincoln to supposedly free the slaves, and the end of the war that theoretically freed slaves, the enslaved Africans in Texas knew nothing about what was happening. So basically, it wasn't until June 19th that they had heard about the possibility that theoretically they were supposed to be free. So this is our anniversary that's celebrated in Texas and in other parts of the country to commemorate the fact that Africans finally understood and got the information that basically they were supposed to be freed in this country.
And technically today is the 150th Juneteenth, the 150th anniversary of June 19th, first, you know, going all the way back to 1865. But of course, 150 years doesn't seem to have been long enough to really break from the culture of white supremacy that gave birth to slavery. If we look at what's happened at this church this week in the broader context, how much of a crisis are we at today, Ajamu? What is it going to take to have a national reckoning, a national dialogue that finally addresses an issue that we just have never addressed?
It's going to be very difficult. I mean, because at the core of the American culture is the issue of race and white supremacy. We cannot understand what happened at that church without looking at critically U.S. policies worldwide. We can't talk about race in the U.S. and not understand the underlying racist motivations and racist perspective that's driving U.S. policy in places like the Congo, Syria, Libya, the reluctance to allow Aristide to come from South Africa back to Haiti. What we see is a desperate attempt on the part of the U.S. and Western powers to maintain their hegemony. And that we need to understand when we talk about race and white supremacy, we need to look at the structures of white supremacy. So having conversations around individual kinds of acts, reducing white supremacy to individual acts of racism only confuses the issue. We need to understand what is really happening with this issue of white supremacy.
And it seems as though the right wing wants to brush this under the rug by simply saying, let's just give Dylan Roof the death penalty, which is what Governor Nikki Haley is calling for this morning, as if we can just sweep this under the rug and have some kind of retribution. But of course, executing this person, assuming he goes through the trials, is that justice?
Well, even the families of the victims are not going to be unanimous in their support for a death penalty. Mm-hmm. It's not about retribution.
Right.
It's about addressing the sickness in this culture. And it is about avoiding this simplistic conversation around race and giving it the kind of political context that it really reflects. This is a white racist movement. He's a white racist militant, and we need to place that within that particular context.
I just want to bring up the fact that after the Charlie Hebdo massacre earlier this year, Rupert Murdoch tweeted, "Maybe most Muslims peaceful, but until they recognize and destroy their growing jihadist cancer, they must be held responsible." You know, if we just replace Muslims with whites and jihadist with racist, we can only imagine why Rupert Murdoch might not be putting that out there today. And it's really interesting to see the hypocrisy around this particular incident compared to many other incidents. Ajamu, your last thoughts on this before we say goodbye to you?
That basically we are seeing an attempt on the parts of many powerful white people in the United States to, in fact, instead of taking responsibility for the kind of culture that has to develop in the U.S., they are going to individualize this with this one person and, in fact, attempt to sweep it under the rug. But it's systemic.
I want to thank you so much, as always, Ajamu, for joining us today.
My pleasure.
My guest, Ajamu Baraka, is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and editor and columnist for the Black Agenda Report. This is Uprising. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. 25 years ago, a historic labor struggle began in Los Angeles that took on international significance. Janitors from around Southern California organized for their right in a campaign simply called Justice for Janitors. While the idea for the movement came to LA from Denver, it was in LA that a major strike in April 1990 took place, lasting several weeks, during which thousands of janitors marched on the streets until they won a significant union contract. On June 15, 1990, officers of the Los Angeles Police Department attacked peaceful marchers in Century City, arresting 60 people and sending dozens to the hospital. Two pregnant women among those attacked miscarried. Footage of that violence captured the nation and spurred sympathy for the movement. Since then, the campaign grew and today, under the leadership of SEIU, has expanded to dozens of cities and includes hundreds of thousands of janitors. The origins of the Justice for Janitors campaign was memorialized in a 2000 film called Bread and Roses, starring Adrian Brody. Around the country, dozens of rallies were held yesterday to commemorate the 25th anniversary of the Justice for Janitors campaign, including one in Century City on the very street corner where the police violence against peaceful striking janitors took place. And the Uprising crew was there on the corner of Olympic and Roxbury. And I spoke with several people who have been part of the campaign for years. We begin by hearing from Pastor William Smart, president and CEO of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, speaking at the podium referring to the massacre in South Carolina.
We're able to accomplish. Last night taught us that we still have work to do.
Ayer, compañeros y compañeras, nos enseñó que todavía tenemos mucho trabajo para dignidad y respeto.
And we must learn from your struggle, from the civil rights struggle, that we are going to have to fight for our rights. We're going to have to fight to get rid of racism. We're going to have to fight to get rid of race crimes against humanity. Are you ready to fight together?
My name is Victor Ortega.
And I understand that you were in Los Angeles, part of the original strike 25 years ago?
Yes, I do. And I did so. I recall when we are organizing the Central City in 1999, so the police beat us.
You were at the rally where you got where people were beaten?
Yeah, yes, I was.
What was that like?
It was horrible to see the police beating the people, the community, the workers, the janitors, so without reason.
Where were you working at the time?
Right, at that time, I always working in downtown LA, so West Hollywood Center.
So you were working as part of a janitorial staff in an office building?
Yeah, we started to organize in downtown LA first, and then we moved into to the Central City. So we knew how we can organize the people, but the police, they didn't. So they think we are attacking Central City, and that's what the reason they beat us. So we don't understand why.
Rocio Sáenz, I'm SEIU Executive Vice President.
So I understand that you were part of the original sort of movement that started the Justice for Janitors campaign. Where were you 25 years ago? What were you doing?
So we were here, especially 25 years ago, right here in Central City. This has been an incredible journey for workers, and especially back then, it was the incredible determination and courage of workers, immigrant workers, poor low-wage janitors, who decided that that was no more exploitation. And then they took the streets, they went on strike, and even with all, despite the horrible violence by the police, the determination to keep on going and to fight for what's fair, it was incredible to see that. And I think it's that a struggle, like when people come together, when they join and band together and fight together, they can win, and that was a proof.
How important has this struggle been for you all these years? It's been 25 years.
Well, the struggle, I mean, it's never stopped. Never stop, but we are always fighting for the rights. See, and we can see it's a big difference between 25 years and now. After 25 years, we have people bleeding, we have people dying, we have people who get abortion because the police are beating them.
The woman who lost her baby.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. And then now you can celebrate after that. We came for invisible.
The invisible became visible.
Yeah. So, and now we can have rice, vacation, salary, some benefits. It's a big difference, a huge difference between that time and this time.
And you continue to organize?
Yeah, because the struggle never stopped. So it always come on, something coming out.
Where do you work now?
Now I'm working, I still working downtown LA, West Hollywood Center. Yeah, but now it's a bit different because now I'm working in the daytime. So, and there, in that building, everybody respected me, a person. Hi, Mr., which is in that time, they never said that. You were nothing.
So you feel like you have more dignity now?
Yeah, that's what we fighting. Respect, dignity, and we are worth fighting.
Can you tell me a little bit about your own background? Where you're from originally?
Well, actually, I came from Mexico City. So when I came here, I never thought what kind of work we can have it, okay, we had. When I see something different, when I get into the union, so I like it. And then I started to become organizer, more and more and more. And
so now you're actively organizing in the union?
Yeah. Yeah, right now. Yeah. I am still be a general, but I always, in my free time, I go to the union and to organize my membership at the night.
Well, I want to thank you so much. Good luck to you.
All right. Thank you.
And that is a report we did yesterday from yesterday's Century City commemoration of the 25th anniversary of the Justice for Janitors campaign, one of many dozens of events happening around the country to commemorate it. Well, we turn now to our final story in our ongoing series on the science of health. In a groundbreaking study of the links between the pesticide DDT and cancer risk, scientists have found that women who were exposed to the chemical in utero were nearly four times more likely to get breast cancer than the general population. Previous studies had not found such a link because they examined direct exposure, not in utero exposure. So in a nutshell, pregnant women were exposed to DDT and gave birth to daughters who suffered the consequences. The study examined blood taken from 20,000 pregnant women in Oakland, California, between 1959 and 1967, when DDT was commonly used and accumulated in foods and other parts of our environment. Of the 9,300 daughters born from those pregnancies, 118 developed breast cancer. While DDT was banned in the U.S. in 1972, many countries continue to use the chemical. Joining me now is the study author, Barbara Cohn, and she's a researcher at the Public Health Institute in Berkeley, California. Welcome to Uprising.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
So why did previous studies not find a link, a significant link between DDT and cancer? Was it just that they were looking at the wrong generation, those who were directly exposed rather than their offspring?
The reason is that the people who worked on this originally worked with the data that they had, and the best data that most people had at the time was information on people in midlife. They could sometimes follow people forward midlife from midlife to see who developed cancer. But there was no opportunity really to look at women who were exposed when very young and to actually measure what they were exposed to at a sensitive period. So I believe that the studies, including a very large study done in Long Island, New York, which found no connection between DDT and breast cancer, did find no connection because they were looking at the wrong time in life rather than the wrong generation.
Wrong time in life. So the study that you did essentially looked at blood samples from a long time ago, and that's pretty incredible that there is even such a data set available for you to study.
The data set is considered by me and also by others to be a national treasure. It started in 1959 by a totally brilliant man who understood that a very good way to follow people was to start inside the Kaiser Foundation health plan, that now called Kaiser Permanente, which we all know very well. And we have been very, very fortunate to also live in an area that has been surveilled for cancer incidents, first by the National SEER Registry and now by the California Cancer Registry, so that we were able to actually follow these two generations of women now for 54 years, understand who got sick, understand who didn't, and were able then to take stored blood samples to look at risk factors for the disease.
Were you surprised by the results? I mean, nearly four times more likely to get breast cancer than the general population. That's strong. That's not within the noise.
Yeah. So the answer to that is yes and no. The yes part is that it is both surprising and unusual to find an event that happens 50 years before cancer to be so strongly related to it, other than something like family history, which does have very, very strong effects on a woman's risk. So in that case, that was surprising. The no part is that we know a lot about the vulnerability of the breast in utero and at particularly important developmental times in life. In utero, during pregnancy, during puberty, during pregnancy, likely during the time that the breast returns to pre-pregnant state during lactation, and maybe again during the perimenopause. So if you have the fortune to be able to examine direct exposure during one of those times, we would expect to get a little bit closer to understanding risk than we do if we cannot measure risk at those times.
So let's talk about DDT itself, this chemical. I'm going to try to say what it actually stands for, dichlorodiphenyl trichloroethane. What exactly does this chemical do in the body? What is your theory as to why it can trigger or cause cancer in women who are exposed as fetuses?
So this is an excellent question, but I have to say first off that in a human study like this, where thank God we don't do experiments, we can't really exclude other things that ride along with DDT as the reason for the relationship we saw. And so the next step is to find out about why is to do animal studies or studies in the petri dish in the laboratory so that you can isolate DDT itself and see what its action really is. That being said, there's been suspicion about DDT for a long time for a number of really good and reasonable reasons. The first is, and most people may be aware of this, is that DDT was banned because of its effect on wildlife. And it seemed to interrupt reproduction in a number of animals, particularly birds. And so that's the first clue that it might have an influence on the hormone systems that are very active in helping the breast form and respond to the needs for lactation later on. And so we call DDT an endocrine disruptor. DDT and its related compounds have been shown to have influences on hormone action in the body. And any of those systems are very sensitive, especially in utero. And so there was reason to suspect that DDT might have a risk via those effects.
So it was technically banned in 1972. The EPA classifies DDT as a probable carcinogen. It is, as I understand, still manufactured in the U.S., but only for sale in other parts of the world. I mean, this is kind of sad. Do you hope that your study might caution those who continue to use DDT outside the U.S.?
So I'm not sure we still make it, by the way. You might check.
Okay.
I believe it's not manufactured in the U.S. anymore, but it is still manufactured elsewhere. That's my understanding, but we'd have to check to see.
Okay.
But this is an extremely important question, and it lets me say why I do the work I do and maybe what the contribution of science is to health and policy. So my goal is to try to provide information to the people who need to make decisions or are empowered to make decisions about what happens next, both in their own personal lives, but also at the community level or the global level in terms of, you know, a health policy. Mm-hmm. And so the problem here is that the study we just did, it doesn't change the benefits that have been attributed to DDT, which are certainly debated, but are there. Malaria is a terrible disease, and WHO's decision to promote its use in countries where it still is very prevalent was really based on trying to save the lives of women and children who are particularly vulnerable to the effects of malaria. That being said, this new data does provide more information about potential risks. And it's my hope that by doing this work, that the people who are making decisions about what to do next with the use of malaria globally around the world will take this information into account as they make new decisions. We know a little bit more now about what happens in villages where these chemicals are sprayed, even when they are sprayed carefully. We know they're getting into people, but there is a movement and a beginning of discussion, even in the scientific literature, about learning how to protect people better than we have been able to in the past.
So just to reiterate, the World Health Organization has declared its support for limited indoor use of DDT in some African countries where malaria remains a huge problem. Now, your study examined blood samples from pregnant women to examine and then followed whether their offspring, their daughters, had contracted breast cancer and at what rate. What about men? Is there potential for future studies to see the effects on men who might have been exposed in utero for other cancers?
Yes, so we have also studied testis cancer and have a published paper on the relationship between DDT and testis cancer. And we did find a significant effect. And we continue our studies. Also, we're not only interested in DDT, nor are we only interested in breast cancer, because we have a very large study population. As you pointed out, we had 20,000 pregnancies. About half resulted in males and half resulted in females. And we have the opportunity to study not only DDT, but diseases like diabetes and cardiovascular cardiovascular disease and hypertension and have begun to publish on those as well. This is all driven by the concept that what happens very early in life, particularly in the womb, may be extremely important to later life health. And we have one of the only data sets that I know of, certainly in the United States and probably in the world, that can quantitate, you know, actually directly measure exposure in the blood of both the mother during her pregnancy, but also the father around the time of conception in relation to the risk that a woman or her children or eventually her grandchildren or great-grandchildren might have in later generations. We'd have to wait 50 years to start a new study like this. It would be outrageously expensive. And so we're hoping to continue this work and both looking at breast cancer in the future, but also other very important causes of health problems and morbidity in later life.
Yeah, it's certainly interesting to see the impacts of exposure, particularly in terms of fathers and at the time of conception. That's something that we don't, you know, even address very much. Often it's pregnant women who are told to protect themselves as much as possible, but certainly the father plays half a role there.
Yes, we're beginning to extend our studies to the father, yeah. And we have really only just begun. And in many ways, it was the prescience of the founder of this study in 1959. I was 8 years old when this study started. I'm the third director. The first director passed away in 1972, the second director 2 years ago. And I'm hoping there'll be a fourth, a fifth, and a sixth director who can continue to use this data to understand how to protect the health of us all. It's the idea anyway.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Barbara Cohn, for joining us. Best of luck in all of your work, and thank you for what you've done.
Thank you for having me.
My guest, Barbara Cohn, is the author of the study on DDT exposure and breast cancer links that we've just been discussing as part of our series on the science of health. She's a researcher at the Public Health Institute in Berkeley, California. That does it for our program today. This is Uprising. Anna Buss is our assistant producer and technical director. Christian Beck is our production coordinator. Kiana Turner is our research intern and our audio engineer. Annie Mendoza is our social media coordinator. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/uprising with Sonali. Your subscription sustains the TV production of our program. Our website is uprisingwithsonali.com, and our theme music is by Quetzal. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Uprising. Have a wonderful weekend, and I'll see you on Monday.